Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. Today we're joined by a special guest in the studio, three-time winner of the Indianapolis 500 and one of the great race car drivers of all time, Albuquerque's own Bobby Unser. Bobby Unser, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here, especially at a school again, you know?
I'd like to start about asking you about your family. Your father and uncles were all involved in racing. Your older brother, Jerry, was a USAC champion.
National stock car champion.
You won three times as the 500.
It
your brother, Al, you won four times. Al Jr., his son, won Indy twice. Your son, Robbie, if I have this right, finished as high as fifth at Indy, won the Pikes Peak, I think, at least eight times.
Yeah, he won eight or nine. God, I wasn't ready for that one.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Jerry's son, Johnny, I think, raced at least five times at Indy himself.
Right.
So the question is there something that the Unsers put in the water out where you live, there near Unser Boulevard, that make you go fast?
I think there probably was, but I don't know what it was because I'd still be taking it if I did. The Unsers have just been a very, very, very fortunate family. Number one, fortunate that we were raised in Albuquerque or New Mexico, but Albuquerque. And number two, that we liked motor racing. And back when I was young, really young, I started right here in town. I was only 15 years of age, and racing wasn't much in those days. It was very, very low-key, not much publicity, very little newspaper, no television. But Albuquerque just so happened to be a place where super modifieds came from. At 16 years of age, I ran an entire season and won the whole Southwestern Championship.
By the time you get to Indy in 1963, right?
63, uh-huh.
You've already had some experience, quite a bit of experience in racing, right? Hundreds of races.
I was racing, by the time I went to Indianapolis, I was racing about 50 to 60 races a year and all over the United States. But it started right here. You know, went from here to Phoenix, Tucson, places like that. Even El Paso a little bit in those days. Colorado used to have a lot of racetracks. Most of those tracks, ironically, were asphalt, whereas New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, almost all dirt tracks. I mean, I met Lloyd Ruby running a midget race here. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the most famous people used to come here and race occasionally.
Well, I want to ask you about Indianapolis in 1963, because it turns out I was a senior in high school in Indianapolis, where
wow.
I'm from. And I had sold programs at Indy in order to, it was a great deal. You got in free, and you actually made money. So I remember 1963.
So you didn't have to sneak in.
I didn't have to sneak in. And you come there in 1963, and initially you're having a little bit of trouble getting your car qualified, right?
Well, yes, I was driving a lay-down Offenhauser engine car, and really wasn't a good car. But by the same token, it was for me. Now, the reason I was able to go to Indianapolis, Steve, wasn't because I was necessarily a good driver then. Because I don't think
that
I was...
That doesn't sound good.
Well, I know that. But I was still young, and most of my racing was on dirt. Most of it was obviously in midgets, sprint cars, super modifieds. Not a lot to lead you to Indianapolis. Possibly, I hate to brag about myself so much, but possibly a reasonable amount of talent that hadn't shown up yet. So a guy by the name of Parnelli Jones, I became acquainted with up at Pikes Peak at the hill climb. Now up there, I was the king. Nobody was better than I was at Pikes Peak. So I became really good friends with Parnelli at Pikes Peak, and he was driving for Ford Motor Company.
Parnelli Jones is a really famous racer.
And, yes, I think he's very famous.
I think was the first guy to go over 150 miles an hour.
The 150 barrier at Indianapolis.
That's right.
Ironically, I taught him Pikes Peak. I taught him how to read the road, how to go fast up there, everything I could, because we were in different divisions. He ran the stock cars. That's where your factory's involved.
So you didn't mind helping somebody who wasn't a competitor.
That's right. That's right. You got it.
Right.
So after that, some months later, he called up down here at Albuquerque and said, I have you a car to take your driver test in at Indianapolis. And a $1,000 deal, meaning some money to eat on. Because I didn't have any money. I was about as broke as you could get. I had a wife and two pups and no money. So he got my first ride for me, which was in a bad car, but it wasn't an unsafe car. It just wasn't fast. Mm-hmm. So I drove that, didn't get along with the car owner, wasn't going to make the race with it at any rate.
You couldn't get up to qualifying speed.
Couldn't get up to qualifying speed. And that's when Parnelli, my dad really liked Parnelli too, and he had kept pushing Parnelli. They had an extra Novi, the famous Novi car.
And I remember that car because that was the hot car that year.
Yeah, Andy Granatelli.
Yeah.
And they had one
car. He was a very famous race car owner.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the most famous.
Yeah.
And so Daddy kept pushing Parnelli to go down and get Granatelli to let me drive the Novi. Now, you wouldn't think that would be a place for a rookie to go.
No.
To the Novi, because it really had a lot of power. Spin the tires pretty easy at even 200 miles an hour, see? So he did, and Parnelli finally did it. We got mad at the car owner that I was with. Took me down, introduced me to Granatelli, and I told Andy I'd sure like to take his car around the track and see if it fits me, see if I like it, see if it likes me. He had no interest whatsoever, but Parnelli Jones talks. You better listen. So Parnelli said, you need to give Bobby a tryout in your car. You need to give him a little test run. So Granatelli reluctantly said, okay, and he made me promise not to wreck the car. Well, geez, I didn't want to wreck the car. I wanted to make the race, you know. So I went down. He told me, okay. I went down, got my uniform on, came back out, ran both ways. And I got into his car, and in the first lap at speed, other than warming it up, that I made in the car was faster than the fastest that I'd gone in the other car. So immediately he brought me in with the signboards, didn't have radios in those days. I came in and we made some adjustments. The windshield needed to be raised just a little bit because the wind was hitting my helmet too hard. And we did that, and the next time I went out, I went 149 miles an hour.
So now, that's very fast for that race.
That was extreme fast. The only guy that had gone faster so far had been Parnelli and maybe Jim Hurtubise. And that's it. And so I was an instant hero. And, of course, Granatelli he did do it. He hired me right on the spot.
And you end up qualifying, I think, fifth fastest in that
fifth
race.
Fifth fastest,
which
in
is
the
astounding
whole race
for a rookie.
For
that
a rookie.
Rookies don't do that.
Unheard of. Especially in those days. And especially in the Novi, too, because it scared everybody. Most of the drivers were just afraid of it. But maybe I was just too used to the New Mexico dirt tracks. Didn't scare me at all.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My special guest in the studio this morning is Bobby Unser. Bobby is one of the most famous race car drivers of all time, and he happens to be an Albuquerque, New Mexico resident. And Bobby, I want to skip to 1968, because by 1968, you're no longer driving with Granatelli, you're driving against him, and he's got these STP turbines that are almost jet engines, and they're the fastest things going in 68.
Well, they were really fast, and they were by far the class of the field in those days. And the reason is nobody knew anything about jets, turbines, excuse me. And they made a lot more power than we did, but at different places. In other words, it's not a normally aspirated engine. But they just did go fast. And plus, it was all-wheel drive, what people know as four-wheel drive. But the difference between four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive, Steve, is that all-wheel drive is each tire puts out hypothetically 25% of the power to that tire, whereas on four-wheel drive, they're all locked together.
I see.
And they bind up a lot. All-wheel drive, this is where the Audi cars, that's what people understand the most, Subaru, mm-hmm. Audi cars, the concept all came off of that particular four-wheel drive. But we started out, Indy, with just a Curtis Craft Roadster.
So you're fast, but you're not as fast as Granatelli's cars, the turbines, in 68.
No, in 68.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely not. But by the same token, we were the first car, an Offenhauser, with a turbocharger on it to break the 170-mile-an-hour barrier. Like Parnelli was the first 150, well, I was the first 170. And then in the they had one driver that got himself killed, and Granatelli was trying to replace him, and he tried to hire me for that. And it was also the largest amount of money in my entire racing career of 35 years that I'd been offered.
All right, how much was it? How much?
Well, I hate to tell you. It's a lot of time between now and then. It doesn't make a lot of difference. But take 1968 and fantasize $1 million for signing a contract.
Wow. That would be a fantasy back then.
And that's what dumb Bobby Unser walked away from. But so maybe not so dumb.
So you're racing, and this is one of those really exciting races, because you're racing against Lloyd Ruby, who you mentioned earlier, and you're racing against Leonard, who's in a turbine.
Right.
But your car isn't as fast, right?
Now come race day. It really was as fast.
Really? Because you reset the cars for races. Is that the idea?
Well, Andy Granatelli screwed that all up, if you don't mind my language there. He's the one that he gave the race away, because a turbine or jet engine, talk about a jet engine because that's what it is. It's a jet engine that runs through gears to get it somewhere, mm-hmm. to get the power to the tires. So it's really a jet engine. And so what happens is they just turn the fuel up and down on it to make more power or less power.
I see.
Now, in those days, Standard Oil.
If the turbine goes faster, the more fuel you
put into it.
Right.
The more fuel you put to it, the more power it makes.
Okay.
Okay. And so it makes heat. Heat is the enemy to a jet engine. If it gets too hot, it's going to break. It's going to explode. Okay. So they go by heat meters, whereas we use RPM gauges.
I see.
They go by heat meters.
Really?
So yeah, that's how the jet engines do it. So all jet engines today are still the same way. So what happened is they have such an edge on the piston guys, and I'm the fastest piston guy that year, and I'm on the outside of the front row. And so what they do is Granatelli got an enormous sponsorship out of Standard Oil to run gasoline. Now, remember, those engines will burn anything. They'll burn perfume. Anything that will burn, WD-40 would burn in there. Anything that's flammable will burn in a jet engine if it's liquid, okay?
All right.
So what he did is he decided to go away from the jet fuel, which the engine was made for that, and there's where it contains the temperatures
the best. Because he's getting the sponsorship, so he thinks it's worth it to go away from the jet fuel to go to
SD. He decided that he could give away a little bit of speed and gain the big sponsorship and still win the race.
Right.
Well, what he did is he backed right into my corner. He just backed those turbines down right to Bobby Unser's style. And so they weren't faster than I was anymore come race day. In fact, I could get through the turns and the short chutes better than they could, even though they were all-wheel drive. They had really screwed up, but they were still fast.
They were still fast, and you had a problem, if my reading about this race is right, because you had lost your first three gears coming out of the pit, so you could only start at fourth gear coming out of the pits, and that makes a huge difference, right? Because, like, what would that race car 0 to 100 at, say, if you could use the first three gears?
Well, it'd be so fast it would be unbelievable.
But if you had to do it all in fourth, it would be...
Well, I would leave the pits. What happened on my gear, it was a gear shift that broke, not the transmission.
I see.
And a little pin, there's two little U-joints that go from where I sit and work the gear shift back to the transmission, two little U-joints. And one of the pins dropped out of one of them. And the U-joint came apart, but lucky enough for me, it was in fourth gear. Because if it was in third or second, of course, I'm totally out. See?
Right.
But in fourth gear, all I have to do is get it out of the pits and back up to speed. Well, now, the turbocharged Offey engine in those days made, without the turbocharger kicking in, only made 85 horsepower. Same as a 21 stud flathead Ford used to make. But when the turbocharger would kick in, it would go up to 6-something. I can't remember now exactly what it was. But the turbocharger, it would take about 4,500 RPM and a load on the engine to get the turbocharger to kick in. So when I would leave the pits, I'd have to leave in fourth gear, 85 horsepower, 75 gallons of fuel on board, really difficult, heavy.
So you had to be losing like a quarter a lap, a half
no,
a lap
I'd lose,
every time?
I'd lose about a lap.
A whole lap?
A whole lap each time I'd pit because the turbines would be gone. Mm-hmm. They make their max power just mm-hmm. off of idle. And so they're up to speed immediately and gone. And there's two of them in the race, Joe Leonard and Art Pollard, that are fairly fast.
So how are you going to win this race? That's the question must be going through your mind.
But I'm beating them really bad in the turns.
I see.
Okay? And in those days, you didn't have to worry about fuel mileage. Everything was okay there. You just drove as hard and as fast as you could the whole race. And I would get to where I could almost, remember, I led something like 200 laps. That's half of the race.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe more than 200 it was. And so I definitely had the fastest car. So I'd get way out ahead of Leonard, come in and make a pit stop, come out behind him. I'd pass him again and get ahead of him again and go through the same thing. And I had to do that at least two times. And so the last time, Carl Williams had a wreck on the back straightaway. It was only about 12 laps left, something like that. And
The caution's light.
Caution light is on.
You're not in first place, right?
We're down to roughly 80 miles an hour.
Right. And you can't pass anybody.
No. And Leonard is in the front. Now, the problem is when they throw the green flag, he's going to take off right away. And I'm going to have to milk that engine for a while to get the turbine lit again in it.
So it doesn't look possible to win.
It doesn't. Well, no. What I did is I had it figured out, Steve, where I knew by now how long it took me to get the turbocharger light to get it going again.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how much faster I am than Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the race or the latter parts of the race, I'm faster than he is by quite a bit as opposed to early in the race. We were real close.
I see.
The track is getting slippery. It came to me. Everything came to me, what I needed as far as the racetrack, see? So I figure I'm going to catch him on the white flag lap.
The second to the last lap.
Well, it's really it's going to be the last lap when the white flag hits.
Right.
But I'm going to catch him on the one just coming down for the white flag on
right.
the back straightaway because I had it all figured in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think it would have worked. And I can pass him easy. Once I get him into a turn or into the two short chutes at the north and south end of the racetrack, I can really get him good. And even if he tries to block me, I'll get him, see? So I'd have still won the race, in my opinion. I really think I would have. But that's not any way after getting it too close. And so as soon as the green flag came out, Leonard stepped on the gas, the turbine died. And there must have been 400,000 people at that racetrack were on my side because they all started stomping their feet on the—
People thought the turbines were unfair.
Yes. They were against the turbines,
they were against
and they
the turbines.
Were for me.
Right.
And you can't imagine, even
so
above,
when the turbine dies, what do you mean by the turbine dies?
The engine just quit.
It stops.
The engine just quit running. When he gave it the gas,
right.
at the green flag, it
right.
just quit.
So that leaves you in control of the race.
And ironically, because he had been ahead of me when the caution came out,
mm-hmm.
he's, let's just say a half a mile ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And probably at least a half a mile. Well, it gives me a time to fudge a little bit and get the offie going so the turbine lights a little quicker for me, the turbocharger. I call it turbine because it technically is one. It gets started. And so when he was just pulling into the infield with a dead engine, I'm going by. And the people were making so much noise you couldn't believe. They were stomping their feet. Chairs were falling. Everything, 400,000 people were hollering and screaming and happy. And, of course, I was too.
That was incredibly exciting, and that was your first Indy win, right?
Yes. And I went on to win it and ran an extra lap. People, when I was going down the back straightaway, totally slow, down to first or second gear now, just waving at the people. People knocked the fences down on the back straightaway. There must have been, I'll bet you there was 50,000 people came over the fence. Fences out there, and it's lucky I wasn't hitting them with a race car.
I was one of them. So if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm really pleased to have in the studio today Bobby Unser. Bobby is the three-time a winner of the Indianapolis 500. He's won a lot of other titles, and he's a longtime Albuquerque resident. And Bobby, I want to talk to you about just another aspect of racing, and that is you've always had this interest not just in being the driver, but in the overall design of cars and what can be done to the cars to make them quicker. And by the early 70s, it becomes apparent that you can add these wings to cars, and that can make the car run better and faster. And I wonder if you could explain to our audience why that is, how these wings helped.
Well, the wings were the first thing that we got. And if you figure an airplane, it's got a wing on it, and that lifts it up in the air, keeps the thing off the ground, right?
Right.
Well, if you turn that wing upside down, and then, of course, do a whole bunch of more different design, but similar stuff. You make it like an airplane, pushing it into the ground instead of raising it off of the ground. And that's what race cars became. Had a big wing across the back and then two smaller ones on the front. Those you'd kind of trim it out with, match up the rear where it'd be balanced aerodynamically. And then after that, Steve, the thing that came along that was really the biggest of all the big things is what we call ground effects. And that's where the race car is going through the air. Just imagine 200 miles an hour down a flat piece of asphalt, a racetrack. And so the air is going underneath the car.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So Colin Chapman with Lotus Cars in England, his people discovered this, that air going underneath, they could make a venturi, like as in a carburetor, or another wing underneath and seal up the sides, and that would suck the car into the pavement, suck the car to the ground. And Chapman was the first one in England that did it. We were the next.
I see.
Now I'm with Roger Penske. And ironically, all the designs that were done on that, is because I did become a self-taught mechanical engineer, and must have been a pretty good one because my stuff won a lot of races.
Now, in 72, what I read was you were experimenting with a car. It's for Penske, right? In 72?
No, that would have been Dan Gurney.
That would have been Gurney. I'm sorry, right. Dan
uh-huh.
Gurney. And you're moving the wings around, but you're not happy with how the car's handling.
Right. The car just wasn't handling good.
And one of the most famous things in racing then happens is something called the Gurney flap.
I called it the Wicker Bill.
Yeah.
The first name it had was the Wicker Bill, and that was at Phoenix, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people in those days thought that I had done the thought of it, the designing of it, and et cetera, but I didn't. It was totally, totally Dan Gurney, and it was such a simple thing you could not believe it. It was taking a piece of aluminum and bending it, maybe two of them a half inch, and bending it 90 degrees and just bolting it on the top of the wings
at the trailing end
of the wings.
And why would that make such a difference?
What happened was, is that, remember the wings?
Yeah.
The wing, if you look at an airplane,
mm-hmm.
the bottom part of the wing really isn't doing anything. The top of an airplane wing is what's lifting it off the ground.
Okay.
Okay?
That's the rounded, more rounded
That's
top.
That's the more rounded part.
Right.
Now, we turn that concept upside down, push it into the ground, right?
To push the car into the ground, to keep it on the ground so you could go faster.
Right, so it's an inverted wing.
Uh-huh.
All right, now if you take that idea, fantasize that. Now, the faster that I can take the wind, the air, around the curvature of the wing,
mm-hmm.
if I could do that faster, it'll lift more,
uh-huh.
right?
Okay.
In other words, that's power. That's where the power is.
Uh-huh.
So, like, if I'm going down the racetrack and I'm doing 30 miles an hour, let's just say it develops 100 pounds. If I go 200 miles an hour, it may develop 5,000 pounds.
I see.
Okay? So what happened was is we found out that if you put that little wicker bill, the Gurney flap, on top of the wings, it causes the air underneath to speed up probably by 50%. In other words, if you're going 200 miles an hour, the wind under the wing may be going 250 miles an hour. So the power is a giant amount of power pulling the car into the ground. Well, it definitely gave us mathematical advantages over the other cars because they hadn't discovered that.
So, and did it give you actual a practical advantage? Were you able to go faster?
Went faster by leaps and bounds. Broke all the... 1972, we broke every track record that existed, period.
Now, how come the competition didn't jump on this?
They did, but they were very slow in getting there. It took most of them at least a year to figure out what we were doing.
Because these things look so simple that it was
too
hard.
Simple.
Yeah, because all it is a 90-degree angle iron.
Too simple. Too simple. And so what we told people, that the little 90-degree angle piece on top of the wing, and remember, it's at the back end of the wing, not in the middle. If it's in the middle of the wing, it'd ruin it. But in the back is where it worked. And we tell them that the wing was weak back there and flexing, and we were using that as a little extra holdup to keep the wing together. And the people believed it for about a year. And it was the biggest breakthrough in aerodynamics that's probably happened in the history of aerodynamics. And yet it was so simple. Any hitchhiker or drunk walking down the road should have been able to figure it out. It was so simple. And yet, the biggest money and the biggest teams took most of them about a year to figure it out and start doing it.
You know, Bobby, we're nearing the end of the show, and I wanted to ask you a question about a book that you wrote called Winners Are Driven. And I kind of agree with the title, having read the book. It seems like winners really are driven. It seems like when I read the book, it seems to so much come down to desire. You know, it's this innate desire. It's this desire to figure out how to move the wing to get a little bit faster, how to do this gurney flap, how to get the extra half a mile, you know, more out of your car. But the book is kind of a motivational book, and I know you've given a lot of motivational speeches. You know, you're a motivational talker. How much do you really think you can add to someone's desire and motivation by giving a speech or by reading a book, or how much? What kind of impact do you think that kind of thing has?
Well, I think it has a big impact, Steve, because incidentally, that Winners Are Driven book I actually wrote. A lot of people have other people write their books for them. I did that one, and I don't even know how to spell very well.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You're a high school dropout, and you write this book.
Yes, and I really did it. And my wife showed me how to use the computer to do it. And without the computer, I couldn't have done it. But the thing about it is all my talks that I give and have given over the years have always been on motivation. And it's always on the word desire. If you have desire, you will achieve. If you have physical deformities, problems, faults with your body, if you have enough desire, you'll figure out a way around those problems and they'll work out. And desire is the root of success to everybody and everything. It doesn't make any difference if you're a cook, if you're an engineer on cars, if you're an airplane pilot. I don't care. It makes no difference. If you have the desire to be the best at it, you will achieve and do better than the other people. It's just how much desire do you really have? How much desire do you... And remember, you can't go buy desire. You can't get it. You can't order it out of a book. You can't get somebody to teach it to you. It's got to be that you want something, and the wants are called desire. And if you have it, you will win.
We're going to have to leave it there, Bobby. I want to thank you so much for coming into the studio today and doing the show. My producer is John Burgoon. The executive producer of this show is Tristan Klum. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on Community Powered Radio, KUNM.